On this week's 51%, we recognize Breast Cancer Awareness Month and learn why doctors are being instructed to tell patients about their breast density. We also learn about the risks associated with iron deficiency and anemia with Dr. Elizabeth Lukel.
Just because anemia or iron deficiency is common, it doesn't mean that it's not harmful.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month to help people better understand the disease and encourage women to get regular screening if they need to. Breast cancer is easier to treat successfully when it is found early, and the American Cancer Society recommends women of average risk begin getting yearly mammograms around age 40. Women who are high risk, and we'll talk about what that means, are urged to start screening as early as age 30. Either way, you may notice that your next mammogram report will include a statement about your breast density, classifying your breasts as either dense or not dense. The Food and Drug Administration now requires doctors to inform women of their breast density after each mammogram. Here to help us understand why is Dr. Arnold Baskies, the former chairman of the National Board of the American Cancer Society. Dr. Baskies currently serves on the Global Breast Cancer Initiative of the World Health Organization and the greater boards in New York City and Philadelphia. He's received numerous awards for his volunteer work and experience as a surgical oncologist and is a frequent medical correspondent for NBC.
Well, Jesse, you've outlined exactly what's in the new FDA ruling. The FDA's new breast density rule will now require that all mammography reports include whether a woman has dense breasts. Breast density is considered a risk factor for breast cancer and can make it difficult to detect signs of breast cancer. So there is some importance to doing that.
And so what is it about breast density that makes you a higher risk or that makes it more difficult to screen?
That's a great question, and I wish that medical science and those of us who are involved with breast cancer could give you an exact answer to that question. What we do know is that dense breast is associated with a 1.5 to 2 times greater chance of developing breast cancer.
Okay. And so if you get your mammography report back and it says that you have dense breasts, what should you as a patient do? Do you seek out additional screening?
That also is open to conjecture. Some people will recommend that the individual patient, if they have a dense breast, undergo additional screening. The best way to approach mammography is with what we call whole breast tomography, or tomosynthesis rather, or what is generally called 3D mammography. And that's a better way to evaluate the breast than a routine digital mammogram. Having said that, additional screening is sometimes recommended, although the jury's out as to how helpful it is, with either ultrasound and/or MRI.
I know. I think the general advice is that, you know, if you're of normal risk, to start getting mammograms around age 40. What are sort of maybe the exceptions to that?
Well, there are multiple sets of guidelines which can be confusing for the average patient. The American Cancer Society's guidelines, I believe, and I'm somewhat biased, are probably the most reasonable and make the most sense. The current guidelines for women of average risk are that a discussion begin with your physician at age 40 about beginning mammographic screening, but definitely begin screening by age 45. Those guidelines apply to women of average risk. Generally speaking, if you're at higher risk, begin screening at least within a decade of the time of the woman in your family that has already had breast cancer. And that's an old rule of thumb.
Dense breasts can increase your risk of breast cancer. I guess, what are the other risk factors that you should be watching out for to, I guess, determine whether you should be testing earlier?
Well, things such as an inherited risk. So if you're a member of a family that has genetic predisposition to develop breast cancer, if you're of Ashkenazi descent, early menarche and late first birth. So those are some of the risk factors. Then there are others that include obesity and, of course, certain drugs and exposures to certain chemicals can increase the risk.
What's considered early menarche?
That's also a great question. So generally speaking, younger than age 12, I would say, would be early menarche. But the
Okay.
longer that period of time between a woman's first menstrual period and her first live birth, the higher the risk.
Do we know why that is?
There's a lot of speculation as to why that is, but there's no scientific explanation for that, except it's at the observation that that appears to be a risk factor.
Is there anything you can do to help lower your risk if you are high risk?
There are a number of things that can be done. First of all, it depends on what the risk is. If you have a genetic abnormality such as BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, there's a lot that you should consider, and that's something that has to be individualized with the treating physician. The standard recommendation for women in that category with BRCA mutations are to consider bilateral mastectomy. So it's a big step to take that, and so that has to really be individualized. What the risk factor is will determine what the best course of treatment is.
Hopefully you're screening every year and you can catch it early that way, but if you're not catching it through a mammogram, like what are usually, I guess, like the early signs of breast cancer?
The signs of breast cancer, generally speaking, are a palpable mass in the breast. So on breast examination, either clinical breast examination or self-examination, a change in your breast examination can be a warning sign that you may be harboring a breast cancer. Reddening of the skin, inversion of the nipple, changes that occur in the normal anatomy of the breast. Those are the types of things that can tell a woman that something is awry.
If you do catch it early, what are the certain treatment options that are out there and how successful are they today?
Well, we have to be careful about what we mean by early. And when I use the term early, I'm talking about early stage. But regardless of what the stage of the disease is, we really have to take cognizance of the fact that so many advances have been made in the treatment of breast cancer. So regardless of the stage of discovery of the disease, whether it's stage one, two, three, or four, we have a panoply of treatments that are available now. So for a small breast cancer, for instance, a woman doesn't necessarily have to consider a mastectomy. You can consider lumpectomy with the addition oftentimes of radiation therapy. So breast conservation is achievable in many, many cases. Even in large breast cancers, we have ways of making them smaller. So again, before any surgery is done. So we have that opens up the options. For women who have a desire to undergo mastectomy, we have reconstruction aspects of care that are just revolutionary, using a woman's own autologous or natural body fat to recreate a breast is now a very commonly done operation. We have lots and lots of different ways of treating breast cancer that were never available in 20 years ago. So we have preoperative chemotherapy, we have immunotherapy, we have radiation therapy, we have reconstructive aspects of care. The best way to approach the treatment of breast cancer is to go to a place that has those options available. And those options are tuned in or personalized based on the stage of the disease and what the woman's desires are.
I guess, where do you see current research for breast cancer focusing on? What are we still trying to understand?
Well, a whole avenue of treatment opened up when the realization occurred that all breast cancers aren't the same. The way a breast cancer behaves, or what it has the ability to do in the human body, is not a random event. It's a genetically tuned in event. Every breast cancer has its own genetic signature. And in 2002, it was realized finally that it isn't size that determines whether or not a breast cancer can spread. It used to be thought that size mattered, but it isn't size at all. It's really the genetic signature of the individual breast cancer that determines what it has the ability to do. That realization of being of identifying the genetic signature of an individual breast cancer has revolutionized the treatment of the disease. So not all women require chemotherapy. Not all women require endocrine therapy. The treatment is really based on what the chances of recurrence are. And that recurrence is based on the genetic signature of the individual breast cancer. And well over a million women's breast cancers have now been identified scientifically. And these tests are done all every day in the United States as well as around the world. So the genetic signature of the breast cancer discovery, if you will, in 2002 or 2003, revolutionized our ability to treat breast cancers in a very efficient and personalized way. The changes in screening have made a difference. The revolutionary drugs that we have available now that can impact even women who have metastatic disease, in other words, disease that spread from the, for instance, from the breast to the bone. We have a multitude of drugs now that are available and safe that can control the disease, and women can live a lot longer even with disease that spread. So the advances that have been made in breast cancer are revolutionary. Let me just give you something to think about. In 1975, which isn't so long ago really, but 1975, the overall 5-year survival rate for breast cancer was 75%. That means that in 1975, 25% of women would be dead after diagnosis within 5 years. Now, the overall survival rate for breast cancer is approaching 95%.
Wow.
Think about that. That's just an unbelievable number. And what that means really is that since 1989, because of all the things that have occurred with better treatments, et cetera, over 500,000 women are alive that wouldn't have been alive because of the advances that have been made. We have a lot of work to do ahead of us, but we have a lot to celebrate from the work that's already been done.
Dr. Arnold Baskies is the former chairman of the National Board of the American Cancer Society and is a part of the World Health Organization's Global Breast Cancer Initiative. You can learn more about breast cancer at the American Cancer Society's website. That's cancer.org. Anemia is the most common blood disorder in the U.S., impacting more than 3 million people, according to the CDC. The condition, which is characterized by low levels of healthy red blood cells to bring oxygen throughout the body, is especially common among women and children and is frequently tied to iron deficiency. Our next guest stresses that just because anemia and iron deficiency are common doesn't mean they shouldn't be taken seriously, especially during pregnancy. Dr. Elizabeth Lukel has been on this show before. She's an OBGYN who has been practicing for more than 20 years, currently with Nuvance Health in New York's Hudson Valley.
When you talk to your mom, or if you talk to your sister or your friends, you hear really commonly or really regularly that, "Oh, I'm anemic," or "My doctor told me that I'm anemic." And we all, women especially, have just incorporated that into our mindset that it's a minor issue, happens all the time. And in reality, what iron deficiency anemia is the last end stage of the disease, which is iron deficiency. The way I tell my patients is, in simple terms, is iron deficiency looks at how the stores of iron in your body, how high those stores are. Iron deficiency anemia is basically saying that there aren't enough stores to make our red blood cells a nice deep red anymore. They get pale and sick looking, and that's what anemic means, pale and sick.
How do you know if you have anemia or if you're iron deficient? Like, what are the tests for that?
The standard test, again, another big issue in this whole discussion regarding iron deficiency, the standard test has been looking at hemoglobin levels. And for women, a hemoglobin under 12 is considered anemic. The range tends to be for women like 12 to about like 15, I believe. But that is now also in contention. And the thought by a growing number of organizations, such as the World Health Organization, is that the woman's low end should be considered 13, the same as men, as opposed to 12. So again, even the number starting, lower can be a problem for women. So hemoglobin is typically the most common lab test used to run to see if a woman is anemic, but it doesn't tell you if you're iron deficient. So over time, what medicine has discovered is that you can have iron deficiency, but not yet be anemic. And all of the issues that we talk about in regards to iron deficiency anemia, such as fatigue, muscle cramping, shortness of breath, brain fog, a whole host of issues are the same for iron deficiency. So because of that, and because we need to realize that they're both a problem, we need to look for the disease and not just for the symptom of it, which is anemia.
I guess that kind of touches on one of my next questions. What are the risks associated with iron deficiency, and what is iron doing that's so important for the body?
That is actually a really good question. So even I was, despite the fact that I do this, talk to women about iron deficiency and look for anemia all the time, even I was surprised when, in doing all this reading, I realized how much more important iron is to the human body than we really thought of. So we most of the time, most physicians or clinicians, whatever our practice may be, typically talk about iron and its role in creating hemoglobin. So hemoglobin carries around oxygen in our body, so it's kind of the energy transporter. So iron is extremely important in that process. So when we talk about being healthy and having energy, we all think that that comes from hemoglobin, which then comes from iron. But iron is also necessary as part of it creates metabolism for cells in our body that create energy for our body. It also is part of making, it's part of all the processes where enzymes are used in our body, and our body makes and uses enzymes all the time. It affects the strength and the activity of our heart muscles, our skeletal muscles. It's also in the production of our neurotransmitters, so the transmitters that work in our brain. And it's a big function, has a big function in our immune system. So when you think about how important iron is, as it's involved in almost every metabolic process in the body, then you can begin to understand why anemia can have such a negative impact, and why I find it surprising that we're very much desensitized to the severity of what we're finding in our patient population.
And how does this particularly impact the body, I guess, during pregnancy? What are you seeing in some of your patients?
Absolutely. So we actually in our office started almost out of curiosity, started to look for iron deficiency to see if we were going to find the same numbers that you could see in underdeveloped countries. And we did. In our pregnant population, we found that the iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia were very, the numbers were very similar to what you would find in lower income countries. And the impact on pregnancy is significant, mainly if you talk about symptoms. When you talk about restless leg, fatigue, shortness of breath, lethargy, all those things really moms are talking about and complain of. And when they are actually, when they actually have the iron level addressed, I am always amazed when women come back and say, "Well, I've always been tired, but I never realized how tired I was until I felt better with getting the iron." The growing body of evidence also shows that for the developing fetus, iron metabolism and iron stores are very important. So when a mom is iron deficient, she's developing a baby that is hence iron deficient and may actually have some long-term health concerns or even behavioral concerns based on not ha mom not having enough iron during the pregnancy. That's not something that we're saying, "Oh my gosh, this is happening all the time," because we just don't have enough evidence. But unfortunately, the growing body of information is showing that if moms are low in iron, we're actually depleting the growing fetus as well. The demand from the fetus on the mom's iron stores is also huge. So a woman may go through, when she's not pregnant, about 0.4 milligrams to a milligram of iron per day in her regular body functions. By the end of pregnancy, that pull on her iron stores can be anywhere from 4 to 8 milligrams a day. And if you don't have those stores, there's nothing for the fetus or the mother to pull from when the body needs it.
Iron deficiency is more common in women and children. Why do you think that is?
I'm asked this question all the time, and I don't mean to, try and make it difficult, but when you think about women and what we do and what our bodies do on a regular basis, especially once we hit adolescence and adulthood, what do that men don't do? And even a bigger hint, what do we do every month that men don't do? So because we have a menstrual cycle, we are losing blood every month. And if you go back and look at medical textbooks, it standardly says that it's about 80 milliliters a month. But my question is, and this is also what newer information and a newer generation of doctors is asking, it's like, really? 80 milliliters. So you measured that, huh? You took all of your products and you weighed them and you measured them and you're certain that's about it. And so we know we don't have a good calculation of how much a woman really loses in iron per month. And then the variation of women who have much heavier periods due to other problems such as fibroids or just different gynecological problems. And that heavy menstrual bleeding is a huge impact on the iron stores that a woman's body can have. So take all of that and then add on the stressors of pregnancy, and you can see that a woman is going to build up over time a chronic anemia based on that chronic blood loss and chronic metabolic demand.
And so, what do you do? I guess if you find out you're iron deficient, are there foods that are more rich in iron that you should be eating, or is it a matter of supplements? What's the prescription here?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. So the biggest is to make sure that you're being evaluated. So that's the one thing that is the biggest key piece that's being missed, that women are not being evaluated with the right studies on a regular basis. And we're not looking at the entire population. Teenagers can have very erratic and heavy menstrual cycles. They are athletes, they are scholars, so they're growing, and all of these things add a demand to their iron stores that we previously haven't taken into account. So at every well woman or every annual visit for a youngster, we should be looking at iron stores and the appropriate labs to do that, as opposed to just the hemoglobin, which again is looking for the last stage of iron deficiency. And then once you diagnose it, if you're either anemic or if you're iron deficient, then you have to figure out what the source is. Is it because that there is something going on and this woman or this young woman has heavy periods, or is it some other medical condition that needs to be addressed? You address the source, and then yes, a healthy, well-rounded, iron-rich diet with or without supplements is definitely a part of that.
Well, Dr. Lukel, thanks so much for taking the time. Is there anything else on this subject that you people commonly misunderstand or that you just want to make sure that they know?
Two things that I think need to be most addressed, that yes, just because anemia or iron deficiency is common, it doesn't mean that it's not harmful. And just because we're women, it doesn't mean that it should be overlooked and taken as just something that can be pushed aside. It affects more than 50% of our reproductive age population, and it's one of the reasons why women can have such huge morbidity, not just in the United States, but globally. So this is a huge problem, and we need to be looking at it and looking for it on a regular basis with the right tests. And we need to think that women's health is important and takes a primary place in our health world.
Dr. Elizabeth Lukel is an OBGYN with Nuvance Health, with offices in Poughkeepsie, Fishkill, and Highland. You can learn more about her work at nuvancehealth.org. One last story before we go. When women are murdered, it's most often by current or former partners. As the New York Public News Network's Natasha Sinyanovich reports, more doctors are being trained to recognize what is actually the top killer of new and expectant mothers. Just a heads up for our listeners, this story does contain discussions on domestic violence.
Pregnancy is one of the most medically vulnerable moments in a woman's life. So much so that Maeve Wallace began studying maternal mortality to understand
why it's so high in the United States relative to every other high-income country on Earth.
2 to 3 times higher in the U.S., where the Centers for Disease Control have long tracked only medically related deaths. For instance,
hemorrhage, hypertension, things that are brought on by the pregnancy itself.
However, the reproductive epidemiologist noticed a disturbing pattern, which domestic violence advocates have long known about. For pregnant and postpartum women,
this is a window of time where it's a dangerous time in terms of risk of fatal violence.
Wallace says significantly more so than for women of the same age who were not pregnant or postpartum when they were killed. She first published data on Louisiana, where she's a professor at Tulane University. Then she wanted to prove it was true nationally. But not all states reported pregnancy-related homicides.
Only as of 2018 did we have data coming from every single state where we could count every single case of a homicide of a pregnant or postpartum person.
Using 2 years' worth of the new data, in 2021, Wallace published the first study showing that when each medical issue is counted separately, homicide was the leading cause of death for new and expectant mothers nationwide. The data on the killers themselves is still inconsistent, but Wallace's study tracks for longtime victim advocate Amanda Iam. She worked for decades with local survivors of domestic violence, most recently at Syracuse's Vera House.
I would say maybe 30% of my clients on my caseload were either postpartum or they were pregnant at the time they were working with me.
Because domestic violence hinges on controlling someone, medical visits are among the few places that can offer refuge from an abuser. That's why doctors and nurses have begun asking all of us if we feel safe. But Iam says, even for OBGYNs,
it's usually like a one-time question.
She wants doctors to track abuse before, throughout, and after pregnancy.
That postpartum check-in to see if the violence has de-escalated.
A Syracuse doctor wants that too. Rachel Sampson of Upstate's Maternal Fetal Medicine Department says medical schools are increasingly teaching OBGYNs to recognize and discuss abuse. But, she says, if doctors have a cold or mechanical bedside manner, they can alienate someone.
And I don't know how to bridge that. I don't know what the answer is to really make a patient be able to come out and tell you the deepest, darkest things that could be going that are beyond our imagination.
I've always said that one of our jobs is to help facilitate your epiphany.
Robert Silverman is head of maternal fetal medicine at Upstate. By epiphany, he means also helping patients recognize when their situation is not normal, medically or otherwise. Silverman points out OBGYNs spend more time with their patients than almost any other doctors and must learn to recognize signs beyond visible abuse.
Not every patient that has intimate partner violence has bruises physically, but mentally, it may have been a forced pregnancy.
Which he says is another common way that pregnant women are abused by their partners. The Upstate doctors say they're working more frequently with victim services and law enforcement to provide help when needed. Advocates say telling a person to, quote, just leave an abuser can backfire. It can shame the person. Worse, it could cause deadly harm if they don't have expert, coordinated help when they try to leave.
That was the New York Public News Network's Natasha Sinyanovich reporting. If you or someone you love is experiencing domestic violence or intimate partner abuse, know that help is available. You can reach the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at WAMC.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.